Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
It's glad to see all of you here.
Amen.
Hope you've had a great and fantastic Thanksgiving. And hopefully those that are still out visiting will have a safe trip back to join us again. If you are visiting with us, we're especially happy to have you this morning. And I need you to know that I am not the regular minister, Elliot. Our regular preacher is on vacation today. I believe he's in Indiana visiting some of their relatives, taking a little time off, and he'll be back with us soon. I do need to announce that next Sunday starts our new quarter. We still need 3 teachers for Sunday morning and 3 for Wednesday evening. So please help out Stephanie and the children and sign up the sheets in the back. Make sure we have those spots filled before we leave this morning, so that will be taken care of. This year is about over, about 1 more month to go. And if you haven't latched on to our theme this year of being transformed, you need to grab onto that because there's not much time left. I would hope by now that all of us would have memorized Romans 12, verses 1 and 2, which is the basis of our focus this year on being not conformed to the world, but being transformed into a more spiritual creature. I doubt that we've all done that, but at least I think most of us understand the concept of not being like the world, but changing into a more God-like person. Now, a few weeks ago, Elliot helped us with this concept. The word that Paul uses in this verse, metamorpho, is the word that we use for metamorphosis. And it's a good word helping us to understand this change. But before we leave this slide, I want you to notice this renewal of your mind is key to us accomplishing that. And so Elliot showed us this picture, reminding us of how this process starts and how change by change, that caterpillar changes into a butterfly. He also gave us this image, another way of seeing how that change takes place. Now, these are good images, and I think they capture the meaning that Paul had for us. I don't know that Paul really was thinking about caterpillars and butterflies when he told us to be transformed, but he does, in this word metamorpho, bear the concept of this change from this ugly caterpillar to the butterfly. That's a really good analogy. There are a couple of things about this analogy, however, that are a little bit misleading. I'm told that this change from the cocoon stage to the butterfly, for a monarch butterfly, takes about 10 to 14 days. Our change from one who seeks after the world to one who becomes a godlike creature cannot happen in 10 to 14 days. It's not going to happen in 10 to 14 months, and probably not 10 to 14 years. It is a longer, drawn-out process. Also, another feature of this analogy that isn't true with our change is that this change is automatic. That caterpillar does not have to take out his list when he starts this process and say, okay, I need to do this. I got to make sure I do this. I got to work hard at accomplishing this. This process is by nature going to happen with a caterpillar. It's automatic. But that change for us is by far not automatic. There's nothing automatic about it. It takes every ounce of spiritual and mental energy that we have to accomplish this change. It's something that demands our full-time attention. So, how are we doing? How are we coming along with this process? You know, there's hardly any kind of special device that we can use to measure our spirituality. You know, Tori can do just about anything. And Tori works for American Airlines out at the airport. I wish Tori would go to the people out there and get one of these scanners. Bring it here and modify it so that it would scan our spirits and give us a readout on how well we're doing. Wouldn't that be great? We could set that up in the foyer out here about once a quarter. And then as you come in, the elders could gather around and they could, you know, check the readout right there. And you're coming through. Hey, great, brother. You're up 2.5% from what you were last quarter. Or you slipped about 1.5%. Why don't you get with us this week and we'll work on that. Tori can do about anything, but he can't do that, unfortunately. But it would really be great if we had something like that. Well, since we don't have that, what do we have? What do we have to measure to tell us whether or not we are really transformed or we've just been reborn? Now, all of us who are Christians have been reborn. We put off that old man in sin and we become a new creature in the sense that the Spirit of Christ now dwells in us. But have we furthered the process once we've started that new life of being reborn and accomplished the transformation that God expects of us? Well, since we don't have a meter, how do we measure that process? Well, Paul kind of helps us out on that a little bit also. Over in Ephesians, when he writes to the Ephesian brethren, he has the same idea in mind of being changed. But he refers to the fleshly life and the spiritual life and says not to walk by the flesh, but to walk by the Spirit. And he enumerates in Galatians, the 5th chapter, verses 19, 20, and 21, those characteristics that are seen in one who walks after the flesh. And that includes adultery, fornication, uncleanness, unbridled lust, idolatry, sorcery, enmities, wrath, self-ambitions, dissensions, envies, murderers, drunkenness, and revelings. And then he says, now one who walks by the Spirit bears the fruits of the Spirit, and he has these characteristics in his life. There's love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, meekness, and self-control. And then when we go back to Romans 12, verses 1 and 2, and some of the other characteristics of this transformed person, we can see that we could add to this list one who lives by the Spirit, one who is a living sacrifice, one who's pleasing to God, and one who has met God's approval and learns what God's will is by doing it. So we have these two lists of things that help us to compare our life with these things to see how are we doing? How are we coming along? How are you doing with that? I would hope that your progress in this venture is better than one of my brethren's resolution to lose weight. Early this year, 2017 in January, speaking to one of our brethren, and he said, you know, I put on some extra weight last year, especially with Thanksgiving and Christmas. I've gained 10 pounds, and this year in 2017, my resolution is to lose 10 pounds. So I said, well, do you think you could do that? He said, yeah, you know, that's less than 1 pound a month. That should not be a problem. I saw him a couple weeks ago, and I said, hey, brother, how are you coming along with this 10-pound goal that you have in mind? He said, oh, it's pretty good. He said, I got a month and a half to go, and I only have 15 more pounds to lose. Obviously, he was not paying enough attention to what he had resolved to do. And if we're not careful and not paying attention, this task we have before us will also not get accomplished. So, here are our lists. What we need to do is take our lives and kind of place them over this template to see how we're coming out, how we do it. Now, we're going to do that this morning, except we're going to use my life. I'm going to be the guinea pig to give you an idea how this might help us out. I'm going to take a page out of my recent past, of my life, and just kind of share it with you to show you how this works. Now, to set this up, I've got to kind of explain something about how my office is laid out. Those of you who have been to my office know that my office sits here, and to the left of my office, there is a recruiter's office that is housed by the U.S. Army. There are three spaces in front of my office, parking spaces. I always park in one. We leave the other two for my clients. There are three spaces in front of the recruiter's office, and there's always, most always, two government cars parked there. Well, when people come to the recruiter's office, Linda and Kim and I have noted over the last year or two that a lot of times, instead of parking in front of the recruiter's office or 8 or 10 other spaces to the left of the recruiter's office, they park in front of ours. Now, behind that row of parking, there are two other rows of parking, another 30 feet away or whatever. There's always parking there. Now, why do these young men who are supposed to be at the height of their physical ability coming to join the Army not have enough strength to walk an extra 20 feet to get to the recruiter's office? It's not a big deal, but it's just a little bit frustrating. Now, we try to be good neighbors to the people next door, and a lot of times they're out of the office. USP will bring packages, and their door is locked because they're gone. And we allow them to bring them over to our office. We'll sign for them, and we'll leave the packages there until they get back to pick them up. Last March, I believe it was, this tax season, toward the end of March, one of my clients came in for their appointment. The wife of this client is in really bad health. In fact, I think they've had to cancel a time or two before in their appointments that year because she just wasn't healthy enough to come. Well, he comes to the office. It just so happens that the spaces in front of my office are filled. He parks in front of the recruiter's office, as close as he can so his wife can get inside and sit down and we can go on with their appointment. So I'm sitting there at my office doing their taxes, and about 45 minutes into our appointment, Linda comes in. And she says to the husband of this client, excuse me, John, but do you have a certain vehicle? And he says, yes, I do. She says, I'm sorry, but the recruiters say you parked in front of their office and they want you to move it. He does. He gets up, he goes and moves the car. I continue to finish their appointment, the tax return, and about 15 minutes later, I'm already a little bit miffed at this whole idea. And I go out to Linda and I say, Linda, what happened here? She said, one of those recruiters came over here and made him, want his car moved. And she said, I told him that they're always parking in front of our office. And he just the same as called me a liar, said that wasn't true. My blood pressure, which is usually about 110, immediately went to about 220. And I said, this is crazy. And she said, you told him to come and move their vehicle. I did not. By this time, I was pretty well aroused. And so I storm out of my door. I walk over to their door. Now, you remember in some of the old movies, where the sheriff in town finds out that the meanest, baddest criminal is in his town and he has perpetrated a horrible crime on one of his citizens, and he goes to the saloon because he hears that the criminal is there, and he busts into the saloon, and his face looks kind of like this. That's me. I jerked the door open. I rushed inside. And I said, which one of you guys told my wife I'd ask you to move your car? My daughter and her family kind of have this little fun saying among themselves. When one of them is talking to the other and their voice is a little out of kilter, out of tone, they say, you're talking in it with a tone. I was talking with a tone. Now, there was one of the officers sitting over at the lab at his desk on the telephone talking to a recruitee, I suppose. And he looks up at me, trying to continue with his conversation with his eyes about this big, wondering what in the world is going on. I look further back, and at the desk of the commanding officer, the sergeant, he stands up. And I walk over to where his desk is. You've also seen movies. Movies where the commanding officer ends up in the face of the private. You can see the fire in his eyes. You can see his ears are laid back. His veins on the side of his neck are pooched out. And you can only guess the amount of decibels in his voice. And he chews that private out up one side and down the other. Well, in this case, I was the chewer and the officer was the chewee. Now, I wasn't using bad language. I didn't call him any names. And he was on one side of the desk and I was on the other. But I said, did you tell my wife I'd asked you to move your car? He said, yes. I said, I have never, ever asked you to move one of your vehicles. He said, well, someone that looked like you did. I said, well, it wasn't me. And I don't appreciate you telling my wife things that aren't true just to justify your own action. I turned around and stormed out, leaving a jet trail of smoke coming out of my ear. I walked back over to our office, and I go in, and Linda and Kim were looking at me, and I said, I gave him a piece of my mind. And they said, yeah, we know we could hear it through the walls. I said, the nerve of that guy. I said, are we still taking packages for them and signing for them? They said, yeah, well, don't do it anymore. I don't trust those guys. We're going to get in trouble. No telling what they're going to come up with next. So I went into my office and I sat down. And then I thought, what did I just do? I've done a lot of dumb things in my life. But this ranks right up there at the top. That guy was 30 years my senior, in great condition. With one punch, he could have knocked me flat on my face and cold as ice. Now, I know military people aren't supposed to hit civilians, but he could always say that he thought he was being attacked by a terrorist and justified the whole thing. But more than that, I thought, man, that's not the way a Christian acts. But he deserved it, though. And I wrestled with that. This was late in the day. And before the day was over, I thought, I probably would have apologized. No, I'm not going to apologize. And I went home with this wrestling back and forth all night long. And about 9 o'clock, this horrible thought comes into my mind. You know, maybe I did ask him to move his car once. Because 3 or 4 months earlier, we had bought another desk to move into our office. And I had it on the back of a trailer, and I needed to back up to my front door so I could get it in. And one of their cars was in the way, and there wasn't any other close by. I think I did ask him to move one of their cars. Well, then I decided I have got to apologize, no doubt about it. So the next morning, I go into his office first thing, and I said, Sergeant Stout, I need to apologize to you. My actions yesterday were certainly inappropriate. I was out of line, and I apologize. And stuck out my hand, and we shook hands, and he just kind of smiled and said, that's all right. I said, you know, I'm just completely out of line. And he said, well, you know, we tell our guys not to park over there. I mean, after all, they're soldiers. They should have enough strength to walk a little way. We were thinking the same thing. And we had a nice conversation about it, and everything was cool. But when I take that page of my life and I set it up here, how do I fare? Well, we can see a little bit of wrath in there, you know, maybe some dissension. How about love? No, no love. Joy? Not a bit. How about peace? No way. How about self-control? Are you kidding? Well, I flunked the test. Bad. Strange thing, however. Now, their door is always locked. And they've got this little button over here that you have to push and tell who you are before they'll let you in. Go figure. So that's one place I would really fail. Now, let me ask you another question. Different subject. Anybody in here ever get offended or get your feathers ruffled a little bit because of what some other member of the family here said or did? You don't have to show a hand. I probably ought to ask it this way. Has anyone not had their feelings hurt? As Tom said this morning, we're family. And when we're together doing things together, people are going to say something innocently that will often hit us the wrong way. Let me give you some background in this story. Now, the names of this incident have not been changed to protect the innocent. But they're all innocent, except me. Several years ago, we had a leaking problem of rain seeking into the office here because the ground out front where the grass was had filled up with dirt and there wasn't enough drainage. And so Alan Ringel comes to the rescue. He digs out a bunch of dirt and he puts some gravel in there so that not only are we lower, but we don't have the problem of having to mow the grass and everything. It adds a little variety to the looks of the building. You all probably know there are several women who are always trying to beautify the surroundings. They're planting flowers, they're putting decorations up, and first one thing and another. I'd gotten rookie duty into doing some of that because of Linda's activity, and I tell you, it's hard work. Well, there was a statue, this particular statue, that someone had bought with their own money. They'd put out here, and it had been moved a time or two to try to put it in the most strategic place. But the kids were walking. You put something in the presence of kids, they're going to walk on it, run on it, jump on it, walk around it, climb over it, push it, pull it, because to them everything is a toy. Well, Linda and Pat thought, we really need to move that because someone's going to get hurt or they're going to break it and it just needs to be replaced. So they thought a good place for that would be to put it out here in front where the rocks are. Because it's just a bunch of rocks, we need something to break it up and to make it a little more beautiful. Kill two birds with one stone. So they moved it there. Now, a couple of months ago, I get this text, a text that was sent to Elliot and to Keith and to myself. Perfectly innocent text. I just want to show you how crazy my mind works sometimes. And David says, would someone tell me why there is a statue laying in the rocks on the west, south of the handicap doors? Perfectly good question. He's seen it there, wanted to know why. He says, well, I'm sitting at the office. I'll have to check. Now, mark that timeline because that's as far as I read before I started responding. But before I responded, these things were text. David says, not hurt anything, just looks strange. And then Elliot says, well, it's been on the north end of the building for a couple years, and someone evidently moved it. David texts back, okay, it's over, it's done, it's finished. I'm still back on this text where he says, what is that silly looking statue doing out there on the rocks? Because that's the way I read it. Now, why was I thinking that? I don't know. Doesn't he have any appreciation for the hard work these women are doing? Who made him the beautifier of the building anyway? David's a sweet guy. Understand, he would never think in that kind of a tone. Well, I responded back. And what I don't like about texting, other than the fact that us old people have a hard time doing it, my thumbs are too big to do that, is you can't text with a tone. But I tried, and I said, Linda and Pat, who have worked very hard at trying to improve the looks of the outside of the building, moved it from the north side of the building, where it is now 2 or 3 months ago, to avoid the kids climbing on it and to attempt to improve the looks of the large pile of gravel in front of the offices. Alan Ringel is supposed to bring in some large decorative rocks for that area, after which the ladies are planning on putting a couple of flower pots on the gravel to add a little color. Why I was in that mood, I do not know. It may have been the Monday after OSU lost another football game. But then Elliot texts back with something that I just had to laugh out loud. He says, it looks nice when you put it that way. You gotta love them. I do, I love these guys. They are great. But was there any love and joy and peace in my text? No. I failed again. A couple three other examples quickly. Have you ever been in traffic and I won't even use the word, on a motorcycle comes between you and the car next to you where there's no lane at all, doing 30 or 40 mile an hour faster than everybody else, way above the speed limit, with a screeching noise on his motorcycle, ribbed up as loud as it can go, it's weaving through in and out of traffic.
Yes.
You know what I think. Yeah. You know what goes through my mind then? I hope he runs into a ditch somewhere. This would serve him right. He's going to cause an accident. He needs to get off the road until he grows up. Any kindness in that thought? I don't think so. Steve has a daughter, lives in, is it Switzerland? She's coming home when? Christmas. And she is bringing a fellow that she's been dating for a long time. And they're kind of serious. Suppose your adult daughter called and said, I'm bringing home a man I've been dating. I want you to meet him. And he looked like this. Or like this. Lock the door and call the police. There ain't no way he's in my house. You know, I just have a hard time having a kind feeling about people who go to this extreme to disfigure their face. You know, a little ring here or there, you know, one or whatever, or a small tattoo there. You know, I didn't grow up that way, but I can accept that. I can get over that. When I grew up, the only ring in animals' noses was that we'd put in a pig or a bull so they could be controlled, you know. And the only people who had tattoos were sailors who came back from the service. And you know how sailors talk. We just don't have a good connection with those. But anyway, I can stand a little of that. Get by, because I know some people that I dearly love that have a little tattoo or a little pin here or there or something. But these guys, I just would abhor. I can't find in my heart anything to think nicely about them. But you say, Bob, don't they have a soul? I don't think so. This guy has had 100 holes poked in his face for these metal pieces. He's had thousands of ink or needles poked in his head, and all the soul has just oozed out. They do have a soul. And you know, to God, their soul is just as valuable as mine. Christ died for them too. I've got to get over that. I've got to be able to look beyond those things and look at them as God does. One final example. As someone who is transformed, who thinks spiritually, who acts spiritually, who's filled with the Spirit, who has shunned the world, who loves God, is a living sacrifice to God. His desire is to honor God, glorify God, and praise Him as much as he can. I think that's a safe say. So, when you woke up this morning, was your thought, today is Sunday, and I get to worship? In fact, I've been looking forward to it for 2 or 3 days. That wasn't me. I like to come into worship. I like seeing the people. I like visiting with everyone. I like being encouraged, seeing the smiles, feeling the love. But this desire, today I get to worship God, is exciting. I'm not there yet. I should be, but I'm not. Now, I'm not like this character. Poor little kid. I'm not that bad. I've left that. But I'm just not there. I'm working on it. Now, why all these examples? 2 things. First of all, they say that confession is good for the soul. Well, my soul had a lot of good today, and it needs a lot of good. But secondly, we need to understand as we try to evaluate our process, there's a lot of things in which we're going to fail. And what Satan wants to do is to discourage us. And he wants us to believe that you have failed so miserably that there's no way you're going to succeed at this, so just forget it. In Searcy, Arkansas, where our children go to school, it's a Christian school, Harding Academy, every year they have what's called a Grandparents' Day. And 300 or 400 grandparents come to their special day, and the kids try to make them feel welcome. They sing songs to them, and each of the different age groups will sing songs. They'll come to the front. Last year, then I went. We go every year that we can because it's such an enjoyable thing. But they started with the little kids, the preschool kids, ages, 4, 5, maybe 3. And they had 60 or so of these kids on the front of the stage, and they were singing this song, and I can't remember all the words of it, but at the end of the song, from each stanza, they ended with, God's still working on me. And we need to remember that. I know God's still working on me. I've been a Christian for 60 years, and I'm still trying to get where I need to be. But I realize that God's will is that I get there. And even the Apostle Paul, the one in chapter 12 of Romans, who said you need to be transformed, tells us about 4 or 5 chapters earlier in chapter 7 that he's struggling with this himself. He says, for the good that I would, I do not. But the evil which I would not, that I do. In other words, he's saying these things over here that I try not to do, once in a while I'm not careful and I slip back into those things. And these things over here that I'm trying to do, I don't always get those done. Well, if Paul wrestled with that, then why should we get discouraged when we realize that we fail accomplishing that? Be ye transformed, the key here, by the renewing of your mind. Whenever our minds get out of character, we need to change them. It's kind of like the computer. When my computer fouls up and gets a virus, I call for Tori. He comes in, he gets rid of the virus, he reboots and starts afresh. That's what we do to our minds. When they're not working right, we need to stop, get rid of the bad thoughts, reboot, renew our minds, and start over. That way, we can stay on track and get where we need to be. Elliot finished last week with this verse, and this is still good advice for us in our lesson today. Renewing the mind means you've got to think on those things that are wholesome and spiritual. So whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, or pure, or lovely, or admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, then think about these things. Renew your mind with the good stuff. Keep your mind filled with the good stuff. And then God will be able to work on you. He can have his way with you and make us all what we ought to be. Let him have his way with you as we stand and sing.
Would you live for Jesus and be always pure and good? Would you walk with him within the narrow road? Would you have him there?